Blog Talk Radio.
Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck. That's katelovingschenck.com, and author of the Prayer Prescription series and creator of the Uprooting Our Fear of Death, Bringing It Out of the Closet. My guest today is Omal Girish, author of the newly published memoir called Losing Amma, Finding Home, a memoir about love, loss, and life's detours. This book is about Oma's journey of grief and transformation as a result of her mother's death. Please join me in welcoming Omal Girish. Hello, dear Oma.
Hi, Kate. It's so good to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's so much fun. And, you know, it's not like we haven't been together before. We had a Google Hangout webinar, which was really fun. And we're going to try and do a few more of those because your book is really perfect for bringing death out of the closet. You know, people don't like to talk about it. They sweep it under the rug, as it were. And when people close to us die, we need people to talk to. We need to have meaningful conversations. Did you find that people were pretty, except for your family, of course, like not wanting to discuss and talk to you or even allow you to grieve in the way that you needed to grieve, which was pretty intense grief, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think what happens is that people try to fix your grief, especially those that love you and that are in close relationships with you. They want to see you getting back into life and being happy and doing the things that brought you joy. And so they go to any length to try and fix this without realizing that grief has its own paths, that it must wash through you, that the healing process doesn't happen overnight. It just takes as long as it needs to take, and that's different for everyone. So, yes, I did have some challenges with my husband not understanding my grief journey because both his parents are still alive, and he hadn't dealt with that. So he clearly didn't know why I was crying so much, why I was in the kind of pain I was. And it was hard for me in many ways to explain my grief to him because he didn't have a context for it. I didn't know why I was behaving the way I was. It's my first time experiencing this intense grief as I was. Mm-hmm. And so there was a disconnect. So, yeah, people who are close to you will try and do everything they can to lessen your grief and to fix it. And sometimes that feels judgmental, but the intentions are noble. That's what I learned later, that what they're trying to do is coming from a place of good intention. It's just that, as you said before, we are not given the tools to do this, and so they mess it up and they miscommunicate. We don't know why they're saying what they are or treating grief like it's something to be banished. So there is complete confusion because of the miscommunication and misunderstanding around grief and dying.
Yes, and not only that, but you were brought to America at the time when all of a sudden your mother got sick, and just within a few weeks of your coming to America, which had to be one of the biggest culture shocks of all, and having to feel so helpless, I would think, and not being able to be right there when you got the diagnosis and to just stay with her until the end, the so-called end. So I guess that was part of this existential angst that you were going through, it seems.
Yeah, that's right, because it was probably the hardest transition I was called to make. I didn't have a lot of knowledge about America except what I had seen on satellite television. Didn't have a context, friendships. I didn't know too many people here. So I came here very excited, very happy to embark on this new life, which seemed like an adventure at the time. Little did I know that my life was going to turn topsy-turvy. Yes, within a few weeks, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, and she was still in India living with my sister at the time. And 8 months later, she passed away. So not only was I trying to learn how to drive and trying to make new friends, trying to understand how life worked in this new country, I was away from everything I knew, everything that was familiar and comforting when I needed that the most. I needed my family. I needed my friends. I needed an environment that was comforting and something that was familiar. But I wasn't at home. I was away from home. And that was probably the most challenging part of my grief journey.
Yes, I think it was, because you had to face what in your own mind was guilt, because you felt like you abandoned your mother at a time like that.
I did feel like that, because I had lived about 5 minutes away from my parents even after I got married. The last 14 years before we moved to the United States, I lived very close to both my parents, and I was available whenever they needed me, whenever they needed to go to the doctor or needed to buy groceries. When one of them was not feeling too good, I would make dinner or lunch and bring it over to their place. When my sister was traveling, I checked in on them constantly. So in every way, I was completely involved in their lives. And then we move continents, and all of a sudden, when they need me the most, I wasn't able to do anything, and just phone conversations didn't feel like enough. So I had this huge sense of guilt that my little sister now had to manage this problem all on her own, my mother's failing health, her cancer diagnosis, because my father was already ailing by the time, and my mother was his primary caregiver. So my sister was all of a sudden faced with a double whammy, both my parents being ill. And so that pushed me to a place where I did experience a lot of guilt for being so far away and not being to be present, hands-on.
Right. And it seemed like, you know, Amma was, and as I said just before this show began when we were chatting, that one of the greatest gifts about this book is that now we all love your mother. I just think she was a saint. And she put up with so much, you know, and it just seemed to go right over her. I mean, your father was a handful. And not to say that a lot of men are, but I'm not trying to single him out in any way. But really, she has some of the most wonderful character traits that we could all learn from. I really highly recommend reading this book just so you can experience Amma. She's just a saint. She's beautiful. She's tender. She now is something that those of us who have read this book can turn to her as for guidance. You know, we can ask her for help, because she would love to help everybody, I think.
You know, it's so interesting you bring this up, Kate, because one of the things that brought me to my knees during my grief journey was the fact that my mother had no context in America. I mean, you know, when your mother is ailing in some way, you turn to your friends and you say, my mom is sick and what do I do? And they support you through that journey. No one here knew my mom. No one knew what she looked
right.
like. No one knew her context. And for me, that was one of the most painful parts of my grief journey, the fact that she remained anonymous to people who knew me in this country. So isn't it wonderful that the universe ensured that everyone in America, well, whoever reads the book really, will come to know her and what a wonderful spirit she was.
I know. So you were mistaken when you thought, well, of course, that was your reality at the time, but then it evolved into this wonderful reality of spiritual connection that we all now have with her, those of us who read the book. So those of you who are just tuning in, Uma Gerrish is my guest, author of Losing Amma, Finding Home. And it's a memoir about love, loss, and life's detours. And I think that it's just a universal story in many ways because we're all losing our parents. I know that I have lost both of mine. And one of the things I just tweeted about was for people to tune in and listen to how the death of our parents can be a real spiritual transformation. Did you find that that was true for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, you see, what can we do? I mean, death and life are cyclical events, and so no one gets to, no one is spared from those experiences. And when we lose our parents, just being present and available to that experience in whatever form or shape it takes is indeed spiritual. I mean, to be able to witness a parent's, transitioning, their deterioration into illness, many times that's very hard. I mean, it's just not easy to be present to someone who's deteriorating, someone who's been your strength and your guiding spirit, and now you're having to reverse roles. But there is a very deep spiritual aspect to it, and if you can come to that place of acceptance and understanding and honoring the spirit of who this person is and being available to what they need when they are fragile and losing some of their mental and physical faculties on their journey, that I think is a huge spiritual experience. And if you can experience that, nothing like it. You're going to be transformed forever.
And I think it's complicated by the fact, I know I had this experience and I can tell that you did too, that we just don't believe that we are ever going to lose our mother. We just don't believe it. And with all of the evidence right there before you, you're seeing them die right before your eyes and you're thinking, oh no, this just isn't happening. You know, this is ridiculous, and I know that she's going to pull through it. I just can't. I've seen it so many times with people losing their mothers. So it becomes more of an extra shock because we're not really facing the reality of the fact that they are on their way out, as it were, and they would like it if we would understand that. And a lot of times the family does not and cannot. You probably see that with your work with hospice. Are you still working with hospice?
Oh, yeah, I was in hospice most of today as well. I think in my case, the fact that I was physically away from her and the fact that I see her deterioration on a weekly or monthly basis sort of helped that delusion along a little bit. And I believe that she pulled through. She would be part of the surviving statistic. And I think the shock of her cancer diagnosis more than anything else sort of blew my mind and moved me to a place where I said to God, it was almost like I made a pact with him, you do what you can to keep her safe, I'll do whatever it takes. And I put my entire trust and faith in God. And when she didn't make it, it was almost like, going to the other extreme, I just couldn't believe it happened. My sister tells me that, and I mentioned this in the book, that she kept me completely informed about Amma's deterioration and the fact that it didn't look good, but I have no memory of that. The only thing
that's
I remember
right.
is believing that she would survive. And that's so, it's very strange when I read those chapters myself today, because how did I go to that place? And I realized that I was in denial, and I had made this deal with God, and I thought making a deal with God and agreeing to do everything that he wanted me to in exchange for her life was a done deal, but it didn't turn out that way.
Well, you know, we're all going to die, and the sooner we have this consciousness within our experience, and the more we embrace this and the more we see death as a natural process, I think that will really help us all. You've heard of the death cafes. That would be, I think it would be fun to have an online, maybe a Google Hangout death cafe where a few of us get together and just talk about death, like have a conversation about death as if it's a natural process, as if it's just like anything. It's not getting into the conversation like, oh, my God, you know, whatever. Not in any dramatic, melodramatic sense. But to talk about it in this natural way, I think we really need to do that. And because we react the way we react, the way I reacted when my mother told me, she said, okay, do you think I'm trying to die? And I said, oh, of course you're not. You know, how could you say that? Don't say that. As if, you know, saying that is like the worst thing you could say. Well, in reality, she was. And I should have thought, I should have honored the fact that she, and she said it in such a way that she was excited. She really thought, well, and she was right. You know, she was about to close the chapter on her life, and she was excited about it. And I should have shared that excitement as opposed to thinking, oh, no, you're not going to say it. You're not going to do that.
Yeah. You know, that one of the things we were talking about earlier today in hospice, I was in a training program, and one of the conversations we had was how doctors don't entertain this whole idea of end-of-life conversations, how they don't want to tell patients and their family members, because they have taken an oath to do everything in their power to keep the person alive, to revive the person medically, and so going to conversations around end of life is simply unacceptable to them. And that's one of the main reasons and one of the main challenges we are having in hospice about, you know, engaging the doctors, the medical profession mm-hmm. in these dialogues. And that's one of the main initiatives that's happening today where I volunteer. So it's interesting you say that about your mother, because, yes, that's a typical response. It's like, how can mm-hmm. you give up? You still have to be around. You have to be around for, you know, for my son's wedding and to play with your grandchildren and, you know, all these things. And we have our own agenda. We don't stop to honor what that person wants. And maybe he or she is ready to leave. It's the soul speaking. It's the spirit speaking. But we are often deaf to it.
Yes, it's fascinating. And before I forget, one of the other great topics in your book was the volunteer, or actually you had a job working with, well, I hate to say old age home, but in a senior nursing home. And your work there was absolutely fantastic. I just love that part of the book as well, because it seemed like your mother was guiding you in that direction when one of the people you were working with gave you the idea of speaking to a mentor. It happened that you decided to do that on her birthday. It wasn't like you put it together consciously that it was her birthday. So that was a real sign from her. And so do you remember any other signs from her that maybe weren't in the book?
So June 18th was when my mentor showed up, and he was the first person to really help me through my intense grief process. So that felt like a real sign from her. And June 18th was when my contract from Hale House arrived. So that was another clear sign.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a clear sign that she had been helping me all along. Well, I went to a psychic medium when I was in the throes of my grief, and I was trying to write a book. Actually, I was writing a book while she passed away, and that was a novel, which... Mm-hmm. It's still in my computer. I haven't done anything with it. And I had finished the book, and I was talking to the psychic medium, and she said, and I said, you know what, I've been querying this manuscript, but no one seems to be interested, and I don't know what to do with it. And she said, oh, my gosh, your mother is saying be patient. There is a book coming out. Just be patient. And I'm so glad I listened to that. I paid attention to what she said. I thought about what I wanted to write next, and that was when the idea for the memoir came through to me. So she has been involved, I feel, in this writing project from its very birth. I mean, it feels like a soul contract to me that she and I made, that she would, you know, get cancer and pass away, and I would go through the transition, write a book about it as a way to mm-hmm. serve the world. So it just seems
That's right.
like she's in my life all the time, yeah.
And now you feel her around all the time.
I do. I really feel her spirit, her energy guiding me. I keep her photo frame on my desk, and that's the face I come to every morning before I start work. So, yeah, I feel her in many ways. I speak to her, and I ask for guidance on behalf of my siblings when they are going through something. For some reason, they seem to feel like Amma has a stronger connection with you, so check with her and let us know what's going on in our lives.
Yes, yes,
I do that. Yeah.
Beautiful. And, you know, it's just the cultural differences that are outlined in your book are just amazing. And that is a real lesson. I know that another book that was written by an Indian woman, and I'm sure you'll know it right off the top of your head, because somebody wrote that your book was similar to that one. Anita Munjol, what's her name?
Anita Murjani.
Murjani. And that book was another intense insight into the Indian culture.
Yes.
And as is your book, very, very, very interesting. And I found it fascinating that some of the things that you had to do because of ritual and so forth, that you didn't know why you had to do it. Because I think the meaning of the ritual had been lost to you, but I wonder if it was really lost on your mother. I think she understood all the rituals, and she may not have bothered to explain them because she had internalized them so well. But it seems like the world is changing so fast, and the westernization of the world is difficult for people who are doing things and they don't really know exactly why they're doing them. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, my mother had internalized a lot of the rituals. That's the world she grew up in. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents were very conservative, and that's the home she grew up in. So a lot of it was internalized. She didn't have questions about them. She just accepted them as part of her spiritual upbringing. So when I questioned them and I asked why we do certain things the way we do them, she couldn't really explain them to me in very clear terms. She was just very comforted by rituals. They were a big part of her life. And she expected me to feel the same way. But here I was, this questioning brat who wanted to know why we were doing something. Oftentimes she wouldn't be able to tell me, and I would say, you know what, if I don't know why, then why even bother doing it? So we locked horns when I was a teenager on quite a few of those rituals and their significance, because, like I said, I just wouldn't take an answer which was, do them because your elders say so. And that's how she grew up. So she expected me to fall in line with that. I was having none of it. But those rituals sustained her, yeah. Her connection with God was a big part of her life. Until the very end, she remained convinced that she would be taken care of. So
yes.
I guess all is well.
Yes, it is. And the autobiography of a yogi is another book that goes very deeply into the Indian culture and the spiritual, the whole spirituality of your people, and of Yogananda himself being one of the most incredible spiritual giants to ever live. I wonder if your mother ever read that book.
You know, I'm not really sure she did. She wasn't a very big reader, and what she read in the native language. She read English, but she didn't spend too much time reading books. Her life was really busy. She was a homemaker, and she had four kids, and so she didn't have a whole lot of time to read. But I know she took a nap every afternoon. I remember that my whole growing up, my whole, you know, childhood years, I remember her taking an afternoon nap, and right before she fell asleep, she would read a magazine that was, you know, in the native language. There were recipes, there was some celebrity gossip, and there were some short stories and things like that, which she really enjoyed. And during the last few months of her life, I got her a membership in a library that would home deliver this particular magazine to her. So that was one of the few things that comforted me when she passed away, knowing that I did a few small things and I did them right.
Yes, yes. So she did read, but she loved recipes. She loved to cook. She sounds like she was a tremendous cook.
She was, yeah. In fact, most of our gatherings and our conversations, our family reunions were around food. She would often invite me over and cook this big, tasty meal. We would sit and eat lunch or dinner and then sit around and just talk. That was our way of bonding and connection. And that's what I miss most.
Well, I bet you're a good cook and your sisters. You probably try to replicate her recipes, and she probably speaks to you and ways to help you do that.
Yeah. Actually, my second sister is the best cook among the three of us. I am not passionate about cooking, so I'd rather read and write and teach, and I'd put those things way above cooking on my list of priorities. But what I make well. I love cooking Indian food. I make it well, but I'm not a patch on my mother, no.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, and then when the pressure cooker exploded, that was another time when I think she was communicating with you all.
Yes. She was by nature a very gentle person, so when the pressure cooker exploded like it did just days after her passing, I didn't put the two and two together because I wouldn't put explosion and amma in the same sentence, you know. So it was my friend in my writing group, one of the friends that I had in my writing group who said, who talked about how spirits make themselves known, make their displeasure known, and their joy known. So it was only then that I connected the incident with the fact that amma was trying to bring through a message and say, you know, and get our attention and say enough is enough.
Exactly. So I would exemplify what you went through as not just simple grief, but I would call it like the dark night of the soul, the existential crisis that really, really, well, as you say, brought you down to your knees. It was something that seemed to have changed your whole way of looking at life. And even though as you were questioning so much as you were growing up and the rituals of India and so forth, it seems like you came to terms and also transcended all of that and were able to internalize the spirituality that you were brought up with in your own way. Would you think that that's true?
I definitely think it was the dark night of the soul, because yes, it brought me to my knees, this whole loss. And I had lost a couple of grandparents before my mother passed away, but the grief was nothing like what I went through when she transitioned. And I do believe that that's why I called it a transformational memoir as opposed to just a memoir, because my whole life as I knew it shifted. What was important, what was not important, all of that became absolutely clear to me. Mm-hmm. I knew that my life going forward was about service, was about connecting with love, with integrity, with authenticity. And I became really curious about my purpose, what I was passionate about, and living more fully from the space of purpose and passion than I had even before. Fortunately for me, my entire life, I have always had jobs I loved. I've never worked at a place or done something that I had to do to pay the bills, so I've been very blessed in that respect. But I moved into a space of okay, our time on Earth is finite, and the only reason we're here is to live purposefully and passionately and serve through the gifts and talents that we've been given. So that was a big message, and I just shifted everything in my life around to what was I doing, what was I, who was I being, what was the energy I was bringing to the work that I was doing. That became really important to me. The fact that I didn't find English teaching jobs, which is what I wanted to do when I moved first, was an indication to me that this is the path that the universe wanted me to take. The only position that became available was a part-time job at a senior living community, and I didn't know the first thing about the Western world senior, you know. I had no context for their lives. I didn't know about big band music and Victory Gardens and the Depression era. So all of that was rich in terms of education and still is, because I still facilitate a weekly group at the community called My Life Story. But it was very clear that the universe wanted me to walk down that path, which would then open other doors, and the connections became clear as I obeyed.
Well, nothing could be more diametrically opposed than the way we treat our elderly in this country and the way you treat the elderly in India. That must have been a real culture shock.
It was. I don't know if I mentioned this in the book, and maybe I did. I probably touched upon it, but one of my earliest experiences in the senior living community was when someone dropped their cane or were trying to carry a bag that looked too heavy, I would rush up to them and sort of literally pluck the bag out of their hands or run up and grab the cane. And most times people looked at me like, you know, I can handle it. You don't have to do this for me. And many times I heard, I've got this. It's okay. I'm all right. And I didn't understand why, because in India, if you did the very same thing, first of all, you were expected to. So if a senior was struggling with something, you just rushed up and helped them to whatever extent you were able. And when you did that, they usually put their hand on your head and blessed you or smiled at you or said something nice. And the fact that I was getting the opposite reaction here confused me initially. I went, what am I doing wrong? I thought I was helping. And then I had to learn that independence was a prized virtue here. So people don't like being made aware of the fact that they are feeble or fragile or needing help in any way. And now, even now, I have to consciously tell myself and step back. Now I'm less reflexive and I don't rush like I used to. But even so, I have to tell myself to just stay still and watch what happens. And if they need it, you can then move forward and ask them the question before you actually just dive in and help them.
Yeah, that's fascinating, this need for independence. And it certainly doesn't start when we grow old. I feel that within myself, you know, that not necessarily does it manifest in me wanting, well, I think one of the greatest spiritual acts that we can perform is to ask for help. And so many people in this country are terrified of asking for help. They don't ask for help. They think they know all the answers. And that's a form of kind of stubborn independence. But the most important thing we can do is to ask for help. And that, I don't know how that differs or not from independence, but it can be confused with needing to be independent. And it is by far one of the worst things you can do for yourself is not to ask for help and not to receive it when somebody offers it to you. It's almost like angelic intervention when people want to help you. It's a beautiful thing that the angels are moving through others to help you.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear you, Kate. And I feel that a lot of this is because people feel that as long as they're independent and taking care of their lives, they feel in control. So saying that I need your help or asking for help in some way is an admission of helplessness or lack of control, and that is scary for a lot of people.
Yes. Wow. It is, well, with certain diseases, especially, say, with alcoholism is one that comes to mind, people are afraid to ask for help in the form of going to rehab or going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and these going for help and receiving the help and opening yourself up to helping others is a spiritual teaching of the recovery odyssey for people. And that's just one example of how people, of one disease that may be hindered by this need to be independent. Because we are interdependent. And really, you could think that being independent, like we are, or how we think we are here in America, could be a strength. It can also be a weakness. And we, as Americans, need to realize that, I think.
I mean, independence to a certain extent is a good thing. It's valuable. But when you push it to an extreme, it isolates. It doesn't help you reach out to others. And, you know, you feel like you have to get it all together, manage it all together. But the real spiritual teaching is that we were not meant to go on this journey alone. We're all co-creating experiences. And in the process of co-creating experiences, we are meant to help and guide each other on our journeys. That's why collaboration is such a huge thing. Instead of competing with each other, if we collaborated more, that's when the angels within us can be seen, can be valued, can reach out and extend a helping hand to others. So I think at the end of the day, it's okay to be independent as long as you know I'm not fighting people off when I really need their help. It's okay to allow them to come into my space and ask for assistance when I'm not able to do something or handle it all by myself.
Yeah, yes. It must have been so gratifying to work with the seniors as you did during that period of time, even though they rejected, even though the cultural differences were so great, nevertheless, they allowed you into their lives and into their hearts. And of course, then there's the problem of them dying, which they do a lot in nursing homes. That must have been kind of like, oh, my gosh, and devastating. But after that, you probably were more used to the dying process.
Yeah, I still facilitate the group My Life Story, and people in the group are all in their 80s and 90s, so I've lost quite a few members. New members come in. We co-create the experience again with a new set of people. Then some of them leave. So it's a constant reminder. In a way, it keeps dance of life and death, you know. It's in my face. I'm reminded of it. And that's what led me to hospice volunteering, which also reminds me that life and death are just experiences. You open a door and you move into another space. You've left the physical body, but as a spirit, you never die because, as we know, energy can't be destroyed. It can only be transformed. So working with the seniors brings me many, many life lessons on a weekly basis. I'm still very actively engaged in their lives. They come to this group every Monday and share their stories as a way to validate that their lives really had meaning and purpose. So when they come into the group, they come into it with this thing of, you know, I mean, I'm 88 years old, and why am I still alive? Who needs me? I wake up in the morning and feel useless. And all of a sudden, just sharing their stories for that 1 hour every Monday afternoon, they begin to feel a sense of self-worth, a sense of value, that someone's interested in these stories, that they lived in a world that had meaning and significance. And no matter that the modern world has rushed on and is moving at a frenetic pace, but we are stopping still for those 60 minutes and listening to their stories, each other's stories. So it's a wonderful experience.
So story is a wonderful way to connect with people. Telling stories around the campfire or telling stories around a circle at the nursing home or wherever people start to reminisce, and you listen and it's a real respect experience that evolves from that.
That's right. And I even created a legacy book for one of my life story group members. Woman loved to cook and bake. And she had this little recipe box in her apartment which contained all the recipes that she had used over time. And she said, you know what? This is of no value to me anymore. It's just sitting here. And I started asking her questions about her legacy. We had this conversation about what do you want to be most remembered for and what would your legacy look like? And soon she was telling me how valuable these recipes were to her. We started from there, and I have actually put together a book for her. Her book is called My Life in Recipes. And she,
yes.
This is a collection of recipes, and she told me a story with each recipe. And we plugged in some black and white photographs. So this book is now on Amazon. Her family has ordered copies, several copies, and they have it absolutely ready because this lady is actually dying of cancer. We don't know how much time she has. And they are going to actually distribute copies of the book at her memorial service. Her daughter-in-law was already having the conversation with me. So that's a wonderful way to leave behind your legacy. It doesn't have to be intimidating. It could be something you enjoyed, and you bring back the experience. She can't bake anymore or cook anymore, but in just telling these stories and talking about the recipes and the experience of, creating dinners and lunches for her family and friends, we spent so many wonderful afternoons. It energized her. It gave her a new purpose. So that was just